welcome to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. This program hopes to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet.
We'll all try to push for what we can get, whether we're a housing developer or an aggregate company or whoever, but we have to have laws in place that have teeth, and when you water them down with regulation, they don't do their job anymore. And so I think it's up to citizens to push our government. And yes, it doesn't matter necessarily what, although some parties are more inclined to protect species, I think, than others, or more interested in biodiversity than others, but it is the citizens' job, I think, to push our government.
That's Sarah Harmer, acclaimed Canadian singer-songwriter, co-founder of Protect Escarpment Rural Lands, and an environmental activist. Sarah balances between her musical career and her passion for the natural world around us. I spoke to Sarah at her home in Eastern Ontario. Sarah Harmer, singer-songwriter, winner of Juno Awards, and also listed as a high-profile environmentalist. Tell us how you combine both being an activist and a singer-songwriter.
Not very well, I don't think. I haven't put out any music for a few years. But being a musician for years has given me some pockets of free time. You know, there's a lot of waiting around when you're on tour, and even when you're in the studio, there's lots of time to keep your eye on other things. So there's some flexibility, I think, there in a musician's life to weigh in on things that, you know, you see that are concerning. And I guess for me, as someone who grew up on the Niagara Escarpment and on a farm and spent lots and lots of time outside as a kid, I just developed a real love of the living world. And so, yeah, I just try to weigh in, you know, and people reach out to me and ask if I can maybe help with different causes, different situations that need more support. So I don't really have a game plan. I just kind of respond and try to, be an active citizen.
Okay. And before multitudes of people contact you and try and get you on board, how do you decide what to put your efforts towards? Is it a time factor? Is it an issue? Is it a regional thing? You're based around Kingston. You, as you said, you lived in the Burlington area, and a couple of things that you've been involved in have focused around those areas. So how do you pick and choose?
It's really sometimes it's just a matter of timing and what you can focus on, but other times it just gets its hooks into you, you know, and you start to learn about an issue that it seems, government officials, Ministry of Natural Resources or Environment should be taken care of, and you start to, as you learn more about some of these issues, you start to realize, well, the Endangered Species Act isn't really being upheld here, and you get, it kind of gets its hooks into you, you know, it's kind of like a soap opera. As soon as you start paying attention, you're into it. And obviously the living world, issues of endangered species have really been on my radar for a while. And it's easy to speak up for Blanding's turtles and Jefferson salamanders and those amazing creatures that aren't that don't have a publicist and that are dwindling. You know, we're doing a terrible job in Ontario of actually enforcing our Endangered Species Act. There's huge loopholes in it, and industry has lobbied really hard and been successful. And so to see something that ostensibly is protected actually not having the real protections that should be in place, I guess that just kind of gets me focused but it isn't a grand plan. I don't I'm just sitting here at my kitchen table sending letters to the editor and maybe presenting at the local county meeting and trying to get our elected officials to use the power that they have to exercise some jurisdiction over areas. And yeah, in Kingston, I've been focused on an area just north of us here called Johnston Point, which is, if you can develop Johnston Point, nowhere is safe, as far as I can tell. It's got at least 5 endangered and threatened species, and you know, the developer did a terrible job when they did their first investigation. They didn't find anything. So they went to an Ontario Municipal Board hearing saying that the place was, you know, not really ecologically valuable. And then, of course, citizens raised money to get a peer review done. And sure enough, there's loads of threatened and endangered species. And so just trying to enforce laws that are in place. But industry lobbies really hard to create loopholes, and so that there's exemptions made constantly, and I don't think that's right.
Well, not to defend industry, you know, obviously they're there to make a profit and satisfy their shareholders, but there's got to be some complicity with governments that have something like the Endangered Species Act, and it states very, very clearly that they're there to protect and preserve different species and the biodiversity, and yet somehow it sort of gets weakened. And it doesn't matter what political party is in power, it seems to go right across the party line. So should we be mad at industry? Should we be mad at the government agencies, or just sort of look at what's around us and say, sooner or later, this is going to need protection. We need to go and protect it.
You know, I think I'm very, like, into details, and so I don't want to bore your listeners with too much nitpickiness about, for example, the Endangered Species Act, but it came out in Ontario in 2008, and it was lauded as a world-class Endangered Species Act. It was there to recover species at risk in Ontario. When we were in the hearing for on Mount Nemo on the Niagara Escarpment, we were in an Ontario Municipal Board hearing to try to protect Mount Nemo from a big quarry proposal. And that case was decided on the basis of Jefferson salamander habitat. The hearing officers decided that it was that the quarry company couldn't protect these protected species. Now, during the hearing, the lawyer for Lafarge said, well, we would pursue a permitting scheme. And I remember thinking, what's a permitting scheme? I've never heard that before. Well, our decision came down in 2012. In 2013, there was a regulation put into Ontario's Endangered Species Act that created a permitting scheme for people to apply, developers, aggregates, industry, anyone, to basically avoid the law. They apply for they say we're going to create an overall benefit to the species somewhere else in Ontario. We're going to put up road signs for turtles. We're going to donate money for study on different types of species. And in exchange, we're going to be able to destroy this area that's supposed to be protected. And we're going to apply for this permit. Now, apparently, according to the Environment Commissioner, since 2013, since that regulation was put in place and weakened our world-class Endangered Species Act, no permit has been denied. So we'll all try to push for what we can get, whether we're a housing developer or an aggregate company or whoever, but we have to have laws in place that have teeth, and when you water them down with regulation, they don't do their job anymore. And so I think it's up to citizens to push our government. And yes, it doesn't matter necessarily what, although some parties are more inclined to protect species, I think, than others, or more interested in biodiversity than others, but it is the citizens' job, I think, to push our government to, we are the government, I see it as. They're working for us, and so I think en masse we need to push them and to let them know that you can't create exemptions. If we've got an Endangered Species Act to recover these species that we're losing at an incredible rate, that really just reflect our own health, too. It's not just like, oh, cute critters, they got to survive. It's like if they go, we go. We've got to push our government, and that means, like, en masse, create enough noise to make them feel it. Now, doing that's a lot. I mean, I want to do more than I'm doing. I got to write a letter to the MNR. I've got, you know, there's always those things, and you just keep taking bites out of it, I think, as much as you can.
I want to point out something that you just mentioned a minute ago. The fact that the aggregate company knew about this permitting exemption that was obviously about to happen, and yet you were in the thick of things and had no idea. So does industry often have an inside track on what's coming down the pike, and they can act on it and in the hopes that it benefits them? Have you seen that?
Well, I would say if they're the ones that are pushing for it, if their consultants are the ones at Queen's Park doing government relations, trying to, apparently they initially tried to change the legislation, and they couldn't change the legislation, that got too much pushback, so then they created a regulation within the legislation, and this is what I understand. So I think if you're pushing for that, you're aware of it. If it benefits your industry, again, we wouldn't have got the decision, I don't think, in 2012 that we did, had these this regulation loophole been put in place at that time. It was put in place less than a year later.
Right. Now, you also had the support of the City of Burlington and the Conservation Authority. There were a lot of players that were opposed to the expansion. Did that add to the good result?
Well, initially, they eventually came on side opposing it. There was a lot of science brought by the citizens to inform our agencies, our government agencies. It took them a long time to eventually come on side to oppose the proposal, so the quarry proposal. But yeah, in the end, they did good work, the city. But I was under the impression, that when the hearing started for us, I thought, oh, great, there's all these lawyers involved and there are all these different government agencies. This is going to be awesome. These guys are going to take this, And then we got into the hearing and I realized, it's often the citizens that are the most passionate about this stuff and know the niggly details more than, a lawyer who's got 10 other cases on the go. So it was an education in thinking, oh, someone else is going to do it for you, and then you get into it and realize, oh, it's actually the citizens that are, and that's not always the case, of course, but no, I guess overall it was good that there was a large consensus opposing the project, but it wasn't that way from the start.
What advice do you have for a citizens group that may oppose something that's happening in their neighborhood? What advice and how do they get started?
Well, details and facts are crucial. So really being careful with what you put out there. Your own credibility as a community group is really important. So you've got to have your facts straight. You've got to, be conciliatory and be, it's all about relationship building, and so it's not necessarily a fight or those guys are, you've got to kind of work together with a lot of different people. So I think generally having a positive kind of overview or a positive style is important. And You got to enjoy doing it too, because you never know what the result is going to be at the end of the day, and you've got to be doing it for the, not just for the result, but for the experience of building relationship with people in your community, with learning a lot about this land or whatever it is that you're working to protect. It's got a lot of great benefits, I think, just getting involved as a volunteer citizen who has previously no experience. When we started our community group, Pearl, Protecting Escarpment Rural Land, nobody had any experience in this kind of citizen organization. So we learned a lot. We kept positive and we kept making sure that we had credibility, that we were understanding the facts and helping raise the science. And there's a lot there, and I think trying to communicate clearly is important. You can get really bogged down, at least I can get bogged down in the details. sometimes you have a short amount of time to get the salient information out there so that people understand and can rally behind a cause.
So compromise and looking at combined solutions rather than a total adversarial situation.
I think so. And I think just, you know, I think having some belief that it can be done. You know, it's easy. In our case with Pearl, my mom was really a big start. She's helped us start our community group, and she's very positive, you know, and she's an optimist from birth, basically. And then you got my dad, who's sitting in the corner of the room saying, oh, the fix is in, you're never going to happen, you know. So, and I guess maybe his pessimism spurred us on a little. But I think you've got to keep the faith, and you've got to just be at every little dust up. Someone said that to me early on in our campaign. They said you got to be at every little dust up, and you kind of do. Vigilance is really important. You've got to be there, because decisions can get made quickly, and typically government agencies don't want the annoying citizen group finding out about, you know, what they're talking about behind closed doors. So you gotta exert yourself, but to try to do it in a way that is friendly but persistent.
Well, I know that other environmental groups in the area were very heartened by the positive results that your group ended up with. They saw some light at the end of the tunnel, and they said, we can do that too. So I know from personal experience that others were rallying behind you and really cheered your success. And I want to mention that situation, the quarry was on the Niagara Escarpment, as you say, it's a UNESCO World Biosphere Preserve. So if there is any area that needs protecting and needs being watched over, it would be that. Your relationship with the Niagara Escarpment goes back quite a while. There was a documentary made. You dragged your band members up and down the Bruce Trail for a little bit, and out there you are out there camping with a bit of fire and what have you. So what's your passion about the Niagara Escarpment? How does that factor into your life?
Well, I grew up there. I was born on a farm on top of the escarpment, and, you know, honestly, I didn't think it was that sexy growing up. It was a beautiful farm and nice woods and some ponds, but it wasn't until I kind of became a touring musician and did some traveling outside of, you know, my home turf to see that when I came back, how special it is, you know, how... We've got the oldest trees east of the Rocky Mountains clinging to the rock faces there on the Niagara Escarpment, and the level of detail and diversity, the Carolinian forests. I mean, it might be modest in appearance in comparison to sort of some of the grandeur of, say, British Columbia's forests, but once you start learning about it, I mean, I had no idea there were fish in our ponds until we did some testing, and sure enough, there's all these little sticklebacks and chubs, and there's so much going on there I just fell in love with it more the more I got to know it. And the Niagara Escarpment is, you know, the rock is 400 million year old dolostone rock. It's holds a lot of story and holds a lot of fresh water, so that was the key too. It's a major aquifer for Southern Ontario, and so not just the things that are growing on top of it, but also the fresh water that it's holding inside of it is precious.
And that inspired you to produce and record an album called I Am a Mountain. So tell us a little bit about that.
So yeah, we did the I Love the Escarpment tour. Thankfully, I didn't have to drag my band. They were pretty keen. It was kind of like touring camp, because we did shows along the Niagara Escarpment with stand-up bass and mandolin and acoustic guitars, and there was about four or five of us at times. And we did little theater shows in community halls. And then when we basically finished that tour, we went right into a studio in Toronto just for a couple days. We did everything live off the floor, and we recorded the songs that we'd been playing on the escarpment tour, And yeah, that turned into I'm a Mountain, and it's a pretty small recording in a way. It's like I say, we're all in one room, kind of live off the floor, very very live feeling. But it documents a time and a style of kind of bluegrass folk that is very portable. So we were able to kind of, we didn't need a lot of production. It was stripped down around the campfire kind of affair.
And one of the songs from that album is called Escarpment Blues. We're going to listen to that right now.
If they blow a hole in my backyard, everyone is going to run away. And the creeks won't flow to the great lake below. Will the water in the well still be okay? Muscles of land. Oh, we might get a load of stone for the road, but I don't know how much longer we can stand.
So Sarah, let's talk about your recording career. Where are you at, and what holds the future? I know you're going to be in Lowville on June 8th, Lowville Festival. So let's start from there.
Well, my music career has kind of, I haven't been focusing on it too much. I feel like when I'm doing it, when I'm involved in playing a show or playing a couple shows or rehearsing with my band, I really love it, but then I kind of get waylaid into working on some other stuff. I mean, I have lots of gardens and I do a lot of tree planting and I do a lot of kind of stuff in my free time that I can't do when I'm totally focused on music. So I did start recording a record last year, and I did focus on it for a few months pretty solidly. So I've just got to crack back into it to finish it off and to kind of, I don't know why, it's kind of daunting for me right now to put the blinders on and just focus on music and getting this record finished and going out and touring and all of that. For some reason, subliminally or something, I'm just resistant to being able to, or resistant to kind of having to give up my complete free spirit nature right now and my complete wide open schedule. Although I did accept a couple of nice invitations to play this summer, and yeah, one of them is this June 8th, as you mentioned, in Lowville, because I thought, well, that'll be nice. I'll get to see my folks, and I'll bring my stripped down band to come in and do a show at the church. I think it's St. George's Church. So something small. I've done benefit shows and a few little things here and there. I can't really tell you what the resistance is, other than I'm just not as drawn to getting this record done. Maybe because I know it's going to include a lot of organizing and planning and just a straight focus on music, and that'll take me away from some other things that I like to do for a while.
Well, you haven't been totally idle. You've been at a couple of Juno presentations, Juno Awards, great rendition of Carrie by Joni Mitchell, and then a tribute to Gord Downie. How are those? Were those highlights, or they just came about, or did you plan on those?
Well, the last one I just did last month, which was out in Vancouver to help to honor Gord. Gord was a close friend, and so I was really honored to play a part in his tribute. And, you know, it was one of those things where I didn't really want to be there. Obviously, the fact that, you know, Gord's not here is not a happy occasion, but to be there with his close family and friends to celebrate him was a huge honor. And I'm really glad that it went off well. I was really happy to sing Introduce Yourself, which is the title track to his last album. So yeah, again, when I'm out there and I'm hanging out with musicians and I'm involved in some kind of a performance like that, I know it's the best job in the world. I love it. And I don't know if I need a boss or something to tell me what to do, because I'm just a bit of a free spirit otherwise. And I should get this record finished before long, though, and put a proper tour together and really go back out there, because again, when I'm doing it, I love it. I think it's just a little daunting when the wheels kind of slow down. It looks a little more daunting to kind of mount a career again or a tour again, but I think it'll happen.
Good. Well, I know your fans are eagerly expecting it, so
thank you.
We'll give you a little bit of push there. Any last words for, again, either the budding musician who has a desire to start, or environmental group that's looking for direction? What advice have you got, and where do you think people should start?
I think people should start wherever they are and what they know. And we need people everywhere, and there are people everywhere. I've been inspired by so many different people. Indigenous leadership as well has been really an education for me. I got to go out to visit the tar sands area and different First Nations communities in Alberta and British Columbia a few years ago, and I really do think that First Nations, Métis, Inuit leadership is the future. There's so much, so directly and spiritually connected to water and our relations. You know, the other species we share this incredible planet with, and so I feel like the advice is to learn from Indigenous leadership and communities and their backbone, because I really find that inspiring. There's so much integrity and strength there, and also just to learn about what's going on around you, and to believe that you can make a difference. That's priority number one. You have to believe you can make a difference, whether it's the big difference you want to make or at least a small difference. You have to believe that you can do it before you set out. And I think that goes a long way. And I know that it's true. I know that's people have been making and do continue to make a difference, and it's by creating that critical mass and speaking out and really pushing. So, and then on, as far as the musical front, you know, write about what you know about and talk about your little corner of the world, because that's what people want to hear about.
Sarah Harmer, thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters.
Thanks, Lawson.